Carl, you've stuck to a similar theme in your books about a slower approach to life. And since your initial In Praise of Slow book, there's been Under Pressure, focusing on rescuing our kids from the culture of hyperactive parenting, as you put it. And now there's a book all about applying the slow approach to how we deal with life's problems. And, of course, many challenges in solving problems. And you're recommending that we apply a slow fix. So what, in a nutshell, exactly is a slow fix? What does it look like?
Well, I guess the easiest way to explain it is by saying it's the opposite of a quick fix. And to me, a quick fix solution is one that delivers short-term relief but stores up more pain for later on. So it's like applying a plaster when deeper surgery is needed. So a slow fix, I guess, is about slowing down, taking the time to get to the heart of the problem and to devise a solution that works not only now by treating the symptoms, but actually gets to the heart of the matter and the cause and delivers a lasting solution into the medium and long term.
Now, what's wrong with a quick fix? Why don't quick fixes work?
Well, there's nothing wrong with fixing things quickly, which is a different thing from what I regard as the quick fix. You've got to fix things at the right pace or at the right speed. There are times when you need to sort something out in a hurry. I mean, if you're sitting at dinner with someone and they begin choking to death on a morsel of food, you don't sit back, stroke your chin, and take the long Aristotelian view. You get up, you deliver the Heimlich maneuver, and you save their life in a few seconds, right? That's a quick fix, or you're fixing something quickly, and that makes complete sense. But there are many instances, it seems to me, in every walk of life, from the workplace to relationships to health, where that kind of Heimlich mindset doesn't work, where it backfires, where there isn't a simple button to push or a lever to pull that will make everything just perfect in the blink of an eye. So I guess I came to the idea of trying to find what the alternative to this quick fix approach would be. And it seemed obvious to call it the slow fix because that's the natural contrary position. But then what I did was I kind of traveled around the world and investigated lots of different solutions to problems, people who were having success in tackling difficult, hard problems and everything from, you know, poverty to turning around failing companies to reinventing the urban transport network in a developing world city, and to try and tease out universal lessons from those solutions and put together something like a recipe for what would then resemble the slow fix. So the slow fix is not something you just snap your fingers and do instantly. It does take time. It's about investing time and energy to come up with solutions that actually work, I mean, rather than just boot the problem downfield.
I'm wondering how the book evolved, how the project evolved as you went around researching. Was it immediately obvious what you'd be talking about?
No, in fact, this was a very scary book to write because I started off not knowing at all what I was going to come up with at the other end. I knew that I wanted to establish or make sense of what would be the opposite of a quick fix, but I didn't know what the slow fix would be or what ingredients it would have or what if it would be a recipe or if it would have just different elements. And so I really had to surrender to the cloud of unknowing, of uncertainty. So I just thought, well, I will take the time to go out. I will pinpoint cases where people seem to be having success tackling difficult problems, and I will just go spend time with them. I will listen to what they have to say. I'll observe. I'll ask questions. And I will just sit with the findings, with the raw material. And for a long time, I just sat there, and nothing came. I couldn't discern the silhouette of what the slow fix was. And then over time, as this percolated in the back of my mind, it became clear to me that there were common threads. So I might have, say, I spent time with coffee farmers in Costa Rica dealing with the problems of how to make a living in the international commodity markets. And I began to see that there was a link between them and what the Norwegians were doing with their prison system. And so I began to see lots of connections and overlaps, and gradually this is the silhouette of something that eventually became the slow fix recipe, if you like, took hold. So for a long time, I was in a place of not knowing. And ironically, that is one of the final ingredients of the slow fix, is being able to tolerate uncertainty. Because it seems to me we live in a culture now where we are obsessed with measuring everything. We want to boil everything down to a PowerPoint slide. We want to plot it on a graph. You know, that phrase, show me the numbers. We want everything to be mathematicized. And I think to unravel and grapple with difficult, complex problems, you can't put everything in a graph or a timetable, or you've got to have moments when you just don't know exactly what's coming next, and you have to surrender to that, let the mind wander, chase down dark alleys, and then you come out of that fog of uncertainty into something more like clarity. But you have to be comfortable with uncertainty. And I realized that only after I'd done all the research. The writing of the slow fix was, in a sense, a slow fix, I suppose. And I only really realized that as I was almost writing the last lines of the book.
You mentioned the Norwegian prison that you visited, which in some ways didn't even seem a prison at times. And also, you visited a failing Los Angeles school as well, didn't you?
I did. I mean, all of the places I visited brought something different to the table. The Norwegian prison system is held up as a shining example of how to deal with the problem of recidivism, where many inmates go into a prison and come out and just reoffend instantly or within a year or so. And the Norwegians have managed to push that number down. And one of the ways I think they've done that is by taking a long-term view of prison. So prison becomes about more than just punishment. It becomes about how, from the first day a prisoner enters jail, how can we make him or her a better neighbor when they come out at the end? And that's something I think that gets lost in a lot of prison systems and a lot of penal thinking in other countries, is that we lose the big picture in the long term. We're just so angry. We want retribution. We want people to suffer. And we're not thinking long term. So we end up spending more money and destroying more lives over the long term by not taking the long term view. So I went in as somebody who lives in London and grew up in Canada, you know, in an Anglo-Saxon world. I came in and thought, how can you have a prison system that seems so comfortable? You know, it just seemed so cushy. And I felt a little bit unnerved by that at first. But then spending time there and talking to the prisoners and seeing how it all worked, it became clear to me that there is a very strong element of punishment. And it's the most severe punishment you can inflict on a human being, which is to deprive them of liberty. I mean, people are in a place which has salubrious surroundings, and they can learn how to become chefs and mechanics, and the fixtures and fittings are very appealing and middle market in this prison, but basically people are unfree, and that's a pretty horrible place to be. So I sort of changed my view a little bit of prisons. I came away feeling, well, okay, they are suffering there, and that's part of the deal. When you've committed a crime, there is some retribution and punishment. That is the deprivation of liberty. Everything else should be oriented towards the long term and thinking about how to make a better citizen out of that person in the long term. And the Norwegian system seems to be a pretty good signal or marker for the rest of us. You mentioned the failing school in Los Angeles. I mean, that to me was an extraordinary case of turning around a problem that we wherever you go around the world, there are failing schools. It's a chronic ailment in modern Western societies, you know, kids in difficult neighborhoods going into poor schools and just getting in this cycle. And to go to a school which was in that spiral and had turned itself around was pretty inspiring. And the way they did it was they applied one of the ingredients, if you like, of the slow fix. They took a very holistic view. So it wasn't just about coming into the school and saying, okay, let's fix the discipline, or let's come in with a policy on literacy, or let's come in with a better policy on sports. They came in and said, let's stop. Let's take the time to look at the very big picture, see how all of these factors are connected. And let's look beyond the school even, because this holistic approach takes us beyond the classroom and the schoolyard to the families, to the neighborhoods. We're going to create security cordons so kids feel safe in the streets. We're going to reach out to families. We're going to get families involved. And in a way, I think of this as the delicious paradox of slow, is that by doing things at the right pace, taking time to do things really well and thoroughly, you not only get better results, but often you get them more quickly. And so turning around this school in South Central Los Angeles, a school called Animo Lock, you know, they turned it around really fast by slowing down. So this is that kind of wonderful irony. You slow down, you do things right, and you get a better payoff, and you sometimes get it faster.
Another transformation that you went and visited firsthand that probably seemed impossible a few years ago was the transportation system in Bogota in Colombia.
Yeah. Well, I've spent a lot of time living in Latin America, so I know how tangled and difficult and just plain unpleasant public transport can be out there. So I was pretty amazed to hear that they made some large strides in Bogota. So I went out to Colombia and spent time with the mayor who had overseen this overhauling of the public transport system. And they created a bus network, which is unlike normal buses, which run on ordinary roads. They create separate lanes with little barriers so the buses flow freely and smoothly, unimpeded by traffic. And it's completely transformed the cityscape there. People can travel across this city of 8 million souls in a way that would have been unthinkable years ago. And it's brought not just the poor and the lower middle classes to public transport, but also people from well-off, affluent neighborhoods make a point of buying flats or houses near the the Transmilenio, it's called, system, or they get buses to shuttle them there. So it's a real melting pot, and it's cracked that code in a way, it seems like. I mean, it's not a perfect system, and since the system was first installed and a new mayor has come in, there've been problems inevitably with corruption, and investment hasn't gone the way it should. So again, it's an imperfect example, but it was a very inspiring example of how you can take a problem that seems completely unsolvable and begin to make real inroads into it. And the particular strand of the slow fix that I plucked out of that example of Bogota and its public transport system was the role of the mayor, because it seems to me that in many of the slow fixes, pretty much all of them that I came across, there was always one central figure, one catalyzing figure who embodied the vision or the solution, or who inspired people, or who stitched together the group or the network, who was a very important central figure, perhaps a leader, perhaps just a very inspiring single figure in the equation. And this mayor, Enrique Peñalosa, played that role to a T. I've ridden the Transmilenio many times, and it's a pretty impressive system, I got to say. I wouldn't mind seeing something similar in London, to be honest.
And in your travels doing the research for the book, what was the most impressive discovery that you came across?
I guess one of the things that really struck me was an example that I looked at in the UK was in the Royal Air Force, where they're trying to create a culture where people feel comfortable with admitting to mistakes. And that's so counter-cultural at the moment, where everybody's bigging themselves up on Facebook and nobody likes to admit that they've put a foot wrong. But of course, having the humility to admit that you've put a foot wrong and then taking the time then to learn from that mistake is often a first step towards tackling a problem or coming up with a good solution. So to see these Top Gun pilots, ramrod posture, you know, really macho types coming back from missions and saying, I made a really bad mistake. It's an embarrassing one, but I'm putting my hand up and saying it. That was one of the first examples that I explored as well. And I found that quite electrifying to see people stepping out of what would you normally consider to be their own stereotype, or the way that people think that we ought to behave in the public sphere, which is to deny that we made a mistake and pass the buck. And for people like that, who have so much on the line, who have such a reputation as being able, strong, you know, alpha males as a whole, to say, I screwed up. I found that very liberating. Also personally, because I was on the beginning of this journey of writing a book, and it made me feel better about my own mistakes, or chasing down blind alleys and thinking, it's okay, it was okay, I went down there, I misread the signals, but it's okay, I will learn something from that, and I go on. So I guess in some ways that was the one that stood out for me. It was certainly the first that really made me think I was onto something strong and solid here.
Because in the book, you must have really been touching on aspects of what it is to be human. I mean, you start off in the first chapter talking about the Andon rope, don't you? And not pulling the Andon rope. That was something that's kind of been cast aside in society.
Yeah, the Andon rope is a wonderful metaphor to describe, I think, where we've gone wrong and where we could go right. The Andon rope is a cord that hangs from the ceiling in Toyota car factories. And the idea is that if any worker on the assembly line, however lowly, spots a problem on the line, he or she can pull the Andon rope and a light will go on, and their team will come around and they'll try and sort out the problem and really sort it out, get to the root of the problem by asking why until they get there and then fix it, devise a permanent solution. But if they can't do it, they will, in the moment, they will stop the whole assembly line until they do devise a permanent fix, a slow fix, if you like. The trouble is that Toyota, like so many other companies, just got caught up in the headlong dash to maximize profit and get the cars out faster and faster. And if metaphorically, and I think in reality, stopped pulling the Andon rope and things went horribly wrong. We all know how that ended in tears for Toyota with, what was it, $2 billion in lawsuits and 10 million cars recalled and a shredded reputation because they failed. They stopped pulling the Andon rope. And I think the Andon rope is a useful metaphor for where we are culturally at the moment, right across the board, that we don't want to pause, we don't want to stop, we just want to put our heads down and plow on, to move through quickly to the next stage without thinking deeply. And I think you talk about the slow fix in a sort of bigger context of being a human being. I think absolutely. I think that reconnecting with your inner tortoise, or however you want to put it, you know, that idea of slowing down, being still, reflecting, surrendering to uncertainty, letting the mind wander, all of these things are essential parts of a life well lived, I think, a full life, the self-examined life. And I think in our fast-forward roadrunner world, we've squeezed those kinds of moments out. We're just stuck on this carousel of quick fixes where we hop from one item on our to-do list to the next, from one band-aid solution to the next, and we just skim the surface. And I think a big part of this, I mean, I've written The Slow Fix, it's kind of quite a practical book in the sense that I'm looking at real-world techniques and solutions to tackle real-world problems, but there's obviously a deeper message, which is what kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of people do we want to be? And I guess my basic message is, and it's been this all the way through my books, is that I think that by slowing down, we can become better people leading better lives in a better world.
Do you look at the book as a bit of a manual?
I always cringe at the word manual because it suggests to me someone who is in possession of the whole truth and nothing, you know, the absolute truth. And I always resist the pressure to become some kind of guru or oracle with all the answers and handing down tablets of stones. I'm always much more comfortable asking questions and getting people to think about finding the right answers for them. But clearly, of my three books, this is the one that has the most of a how-to feel and atmosphere to it. So yeah, I'm not uncomfortable with the idea of a manual. I do hope that people will read it and come away with concrete levers to pull and techniques and approaches that will help them in their real life. So in that sense, I suppose I can accept the term manual for this book.
Because I wonder what you envisage readers doing with what they find in the book. I guess for you to know how people actually go about applying some of what you've written about would be, I guess, an endorsement of a better way to tackle problems.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that really keeps me going, because writing is a pretty lonely life. I do a lot of public speaking, so I get out of the proverbial garret and meet people as well. But, you know, you spend a lot of time alone. And as a writer, you can put words out there. And if you don't hear back from people, it can seem after a while a bit pointless. But thankfully, I'm not in that position. I do hear back from people all the time. And that's really what keeps me plowing on is hearing how people, so many people in so many different walks of life, in so many different countries, come to the books and then come back to me and say, well, look, I took this one idea here or that idea there, and this is what I did in my family. This is what I did in my organization, my company. This is what I'm doing as a politician. This is what I'm doing as a city councillor about urban, you know, so I know that these things are rippling out there, these ideas. They're not just, people aren't just reading them and then moving on or not reading them. They're reading them and real change is happening. So that's a really thrilling place to be, actually, I must say.
And the book is very much about practical ways to solve problems, but I guess there are some problems that we can't solve at all.
Well, look, absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the themes of the book, or one of the conclusions, if you like, is that what does it even mean to solve a problem? Do we even know what solving poverty would look like, or a permanent solution to climate change? I mean, these things are so open-ended and nebulous and ever-shifting and always changing that in a lot of ways, and this is what I found with many, perhaps even most of the solutions and case studies that I marshaled in the book, was that they were mostly all works in progress, that you never, almost never, with a really, really difficult, complex problem, get to a point where that's it. You can forget about it. It's all done and dusted. Things are always, the goalposts are always moving, circumstances shift, and you always got to be on parade. You've always got to be aware of what's happening and moving with it and evolving your solutions. And in some ways, I think maybe it's an unhelpful idea to talk about solutions in a way. I mean, it sounds a little bit weird coming from an author who's written a book about how to tackle problems, but maybe part of our problem is the absolutism of the word solution. It gives the impression of an endpoint. And I think that from what I've discovered and uncovered and tried to make sense of is that hems us in. Because if you're looking for an absolute solution, you're almost always going to be disappointed. And you probably will find yourself narrowing your horizons, closing the lens down and coming up with less useful and less good answers.
And I guess if we adopt the slow fix, we're going to be looking at ways to kind of self-assess and monitor and to notice. All those kind of qualities we'll need, and we'll need a certain amount of consciousness that we take to deal with our lives, I guess.
I completely agree that a big part of engineering a slow fix is, I mean, it's like what Gandhi said, you know, be the change that you want to see in the world. If you want to forge a slow fix for a difficult solution, you can't do it if you yourself are underslept, overcaffeinated, frazzled, frenetic, unable to focus or be in the moment. You know, you've got to have a kind of slow spirit yourself. You've got to be able to be still. You've got to be able to be present. You've got to be able to be fully conscious of what's going on and engaged in every moment. And that's a deep inner change that has to be brought about. And it has to go hand in hand with any kind of real world problem solving. The two, you cannot have one without the other, because you can't really engineer a slow fix, whether in the workplace or in politics or in social policy or in your private life. You can't bring that about without a change in your own consciousness. Well, your own, you can't come to the table with the old consciousness. You've got to come with a new spirit, a slow spirit, I would call it, to make that slow fix happen.
And you talk about a simple personal example in the book of how you've applied the slow fix, don't you?
Yeah, for me, it was very personal, the starting point for writing this book, because here I was, you know, gallivanting around the world, telling everyone how wonderful it is to slow down. And you know, I have made a slow life. I mean, I don't feel rushed anymore, and I have a very clear before and after, and I'm living a great deal of what I'm writing about. But in one aspect of my life, I had remained wedded to the quick fix, and that was my back, where I've had back trouble for many years, since my early 20s. And I had just got on that merry-go-round of quick fixes. So if you can think of a back cure, you know, I've been there and done that, whether it's acupuncture, crystals, you know, ergonomic chair. I've just done it all and just cycled through one thing after another impatiently, never trying genuinely to get to the root of the problem, but just dealing with symptoms and moving on. And a couple of years ago, I, for the first time ever, had real trouble with my back. And I thought it was a kind of wake-up call that I wasn't on that score practicing what I was preaching. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I should be taking this lens and putting it on the business of solving my back trouble. And then I, then from this next step from there, was to think, well, maybe I should look at health in general in terms of quick fixes and slow fixes. And then I went in on that route, but it very quickly became obvious to me that I had to take a broader canvas, and I couldn't just talk about health. And it kind of went from there. So it was very much for me a personal starting point, this realization that I wasn't walking the talk with my own back. And there the news is good. You know, I took a hard look at what was wrong with my back for the first time ever. I did a lot of reading, a lot of canvassing of opinion, and I took up yoga for the first time ever seriously and you know, regularly. I've just actually done yoga this morning, and it's made a huge difference. My back's feeling better than it has for a long, long time. It's not perfect, but like any slow fix, it's a work in progress.
Now, your initial book on this topic, In Praise of Slow, came out a decade ago. Where is the whole concept of slowness right now compared with then in our world?
Well, to me, the slow revolution has just exploded in ways that I could never, ever have imagined 10 years ago. I mean, when I first came up with the idea of a slow movement, in inverted commas, and I put it into Google before I wrote In Praise of Slow, nothing came up. I mean, zero. Nobody was talking about a slow movement at all. And now you put it into Google now, and you'll get, depending on when and where you are, you'll get over a million hits. And people are under this umbrella term of slow, the idea of doing things at the right speed, of doing things not as fast as possible, but as well as possible. People are applying that notion to every walk of life. So there are movements now for, well, slow food was around when I first started writing, but there's, and slow cities, but there's big slow design. Slow travel is huge in the traveling. There's a big slow medicine movement, people bringing this slow thinking to the medical world. In the workplace, people talking about slow work, slow technology, slow media, slow leadership. In the personal sphere, there's a big push towards slow sex, slow family, slow parenting. You know, it's where essentially wherever you look now, people are using that English word slow as a shorthand for a better, more balanced way of doing everything. And you know, we haven't created a slow world. The slow revolution will be slow. It's not going to happen next week. We're already 10 years in, and it's, you know, we're still a long way to go. But I feel optimistic. I do feel that more and more people are waking up to the fact that this roadrunner approach to everything is taking a toll, and it's backfiring on everything, including the financial system. There's a book came out a little while ago from a big investor in London called Slow Finance, looking at how to bring this slow thinking into the financial world. There's talk of introducing 1-second auctions on financial markets to get away from the crazy speed of high frequency trading. So all of, you know, these things, these ideas are getting infiltrating even the fastest corners of the world, and the fastest people in the world in Silicon Valley are embracing mindfulness and meditation in droves, because the truth is that by shifting gears, by having moments when you slow down with meditation, you can rewire the brain, which allows you to cope better with faster times. So again, that delicious paradox of slowing down, helping you to go faster when you need to. So my view at the moment is that it's a bit like any other social revolution. You think of the feminist revolution, you know, 40 years ago, feminists said, this is wrong, we need to change the world. And the mainstream view was, forget it, this is the way it's always been, you can't change it, go back to the kitchen. that you look 40 years on, and of course we haven't created a perfect world of gender equality. We're still a long way, but we've come amazingly far in 40 years. I look at my grandmother and my sister or my daughter and think of the way their lives will be different. It's extraordinary. And I think that the slow revolution is on that same arc. You know, let's say we're 10 years in, we're not there yet, but you know, I think 20 years from now, we'll look back and think, wow, you know, why did we ever think it was impossible to slow down? I'm not a fundamentalist of slow. I love speed. It's good to go fast. But it's about relearning that lost art of shifting gears. It's about understanding that slow has a role to play in the 21st century. And I think that more and more people are alert and aware of that. And so I feel definitely in the glass half full camp.
And I think we mentioned last time possibly about not wearing a watch, and I'm noticing that you're not wearing a watch today. I'm just thinking, wow, you know, we revolve our lives so much around time, don't we?
We do, and we have developed a neurotic relationship with time, so that, and we know from the research that as soon as people see a clock, it changes their relationship to time. They start worrying about the time more. That's why casinos never have clocks in them, because they want you to forget the time, stay there longer, slow down and spend more money, right? And I think, of course, it's important to be punctual. I'm very punctual, and I don't miss deadlines. And it's important to be aware of time. But I think that we can develop and forge a more fluid and less neurotic relationship with it by one thing, I think, is by not having a watch on your wrist. You know, it does make a difference. And also by scheduling fewer things so that you're not so crushed up against the clock. But it's interesting. I think this idea of not wearing a watch is becoming more and more popular, especially among the young who have their phones and the time is there. So it's not visible all the time, the clock, but it's available when you need it. So I think that's one little lever that people can pull, is to get away from the tyranny of time. But I guess there's a bigger philosophical change that has to occur. We have to think about time in different ways. We've got to think about it less as a finite resource. It's always running away from us, and go from there to believing that the best way to get value for our time is to squeeze more and more into less and less time, because it's patently not the case. The best way to get value for your time is to do less and to do things well, you know, thoroughly, to be fully engaged with them and to enjoy them to the maximum, rather than just tick boxes and cram more and more in. So I guess less is more. That approach, I think, to time, or using time, means that we feel less rushed, less hurried, I think.
It's funny, because since we last met, we're probably filling up our time even more with the use of our phones, because we're able to do so much more with them. And yet we forget that there is a way to handle that and to switch them off.
Exactly. I mean, it's a great deal of this slowing down comes down to discipline. And I have all the gadgets. I have an iPhone and Wi-Fi, laptop, and all that stuff. And they're great, and I think they're wonderful, but they all have a little red button that says off on it. And, you know, no one else is going to push that button for you but you. And we can do it. I mean, no one needs to be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They simply don't. And if you feel that you are, or think that you are, or your company says that you are, then that your company is badly run. You know, people need the space and the time to disconnect, to be undistracted, to recharge their batteries, to let their minds wander, to think deeply. That's how they become healthier, happier, but also more productive. And I think, like any new technology that comes along, it takes time to work out the cultural norms and social etiquette around. And I think we're just kind of at that point now with this round-the-clock, always-on technology, as people are increasingly, it's becoming socially unacceptable to whip out your phone at the dinner table or to have a loud conversation on a train carriage. You know, these things are starting to change, and they're changing for a reason, which is that we're getting too much of a good thing. You know, these gadgets are backfiring on us, and we know it. You know, they're getting in the way of our private lives. They make it hard for us to focus and enjoy the moment. I mean, there was some research that came out a little while ago saying that 20% of people now interrupt lovemaking to read an email or send a text or, I don't know, fire off a tweet. And you think, wow, what on earth is... it makes you think people aren't really doing the lovemaking right if they can do that. But you think if a society reaches a point where people can't even make love without being distracted by their gadgets, then, you know, then we've lost our bearings. And increasingly, people are waking up to that, I think.
Carl, thanks very much.
Thank you.